access number 28678, Captain Demet Rhodes, Reel 18. Now, we were talking about your job as captain of the fleet. You know, now anything else about this period, because you're sort of alongside the great and the good here.
Yes, I used to do quite a lot of briefing of senior naval officers and politicians as they came around the headquarters. Particularly various types and variations of defence ministers. I got quite cynical about looking at and hearing what they said in private and then what they said in public, which quite often didn't tally at all. Funnily enough, I'd first met this with Dennis Healy out in the Gulf years and years and years ago, and his visit was scheduled. The ship I was in, a frigate, he was going to come aboard and talk to us. And the chief mate also said, "Oh, we're going to tell him what we really think, you know, tell him this, tell him that, tell him the other." I said, "Oh, yeah. And the great man arrived, and they didn't get a word in edgeways. He just talked. And then he said afterwards to me, he said, "Well, that's, if you're expecting a rough reception, get the first bulletin."
So what do you remember?
And the same thing as, well, I remember Archie Hamilton coming. He was a very affable chap, conservative. He was not the defence minister, he was the secretary of state. We had a very amiable, affable chat about this, that and the other, and he said, "Oh, well, you're not going to get this and you're not going to get that." And then in public he would be saying to the sailors, "Well, there is a possibility you'll get this and get that, and we're doing all we can and blah, blah, blah." I remember being invited to lunch by the commander-in-chief. I suppose there were about a dozen of us there, when Alan Clark, who was another, he was Secretary of State, procurement executive he was, and he'd had a very, very good pre-lunch drinking session, and we sat around the table, and I just sat there, open mouth, listening to him being incredibly disloyal about the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, and I thought, how can he say things like that? Wouldn't dream of doing things like that. But subsequent events explained to me probably the reason why. I think he thought he should have been promoted when he wasn't. So I got a bit disillusioned with politicians, and that was another reason for me not wanting to go to the Ministry of Defence and dealing with them on a permanent basis. A weak reason anyway. But as I say, I went over the world, went to the Falklands for the first time.
Now tell me about that. What do you
remember? Which lies an opener. Well, I went to the Falklands as part of my duties to go around and talk to people. And this was not all that long after the war, but we still maintain a base there. Funnily enough, a friend of mine was the admiral out there at the time. I did the same out there. But, of course, A, it took a long time to get out there. And B, I tended to stay for a bit longer to see operations. And so I talked more to the people there. And I was actually attended guest of honour for a mess dinner. The chief petty officers there, which was an unusual occurrence. And very interesting. I felt quite privileged to do that.
Anywhere else you went particularly, noticeable places?
Oh, no, sir. I remember going to Hong Kong and getting upgraded from tourist or whatever it is to first class by, obviously, some friend from HMS Terror who knew the airport authorities, which spoilt me flying anywhere else. I remember and going around there and having a wonderful time in the last stages of Hong Kong, seeing the people, actually going to their married quarters and talking to wives about the conditions they were living in, which were not all that brilliant, actually, certainly for junior ratings, quite noisy flats in the middle of Hong Kong. And really, they needed more help and more support. So we got that sorted out with them. And then another memorable trip, when I flew with the Commander-in-Chief to the Middle East. on a trip there, and because I was with him personally, again, I flew first class and stayed in some five-star hotel, the like of which I've never seen before. And we were visiting then Muscat and other places, because we had at the time a British admiral out there in charge of their navy, who was about to be relieved by a local guy. I did not very much more than carry the admiral's bags for him or make sure he got on the right plane at the right time. But talked to some of the, we had some ratings on secondment out there, so I talked to them about their conditions.
Now, you're sort of winding down in a way.
Yes, I mean, we're running
when
down.
When did you find that you weren't going to be kept, that there was no promotion?
Well, I retired.
How did it all end? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I think the last day of pay was something like 19th of July, 1991. Now, the rundown started.
When did it become apparent you weren't going to get another post? You weren't going
sometime
to
before that, because I did resettlement courses. I think early in 91, I was sent for by the Admiral Ben Bathurst and said, "You know, you've done a fabulous job, great stuff there, but I'm afraid you've not been selected for promotion to Admiral," which was no surprise, and in some ways a relief.
Why?
Well, I think with my own making, my limited experience to some extent in some of the more esoteric appointments, you know, not going doing the Ministry of Defence and so forth, would have very much limited my employment as an admiral, very much limited, and the sorts of jobs I would have liked would have probably not been available to me. And I also knew my own limitations. And I could see a lot of very bright young chaps who do far the better than I would. Some of them sadly weren't selected, and some who were not so good were selected, but that's another story.
Now, what about these resettlement courses?
Well, if I can run down a little more gently than that, because one of the very last major tasks I had to do is the commander chief sent to me one day and said, "I would like you to write the rules for Wren's going to sea." Now, we'd been forced into this. We'd gone so far in contingency plans, but it was Archie Hamilton who pressed it and said, "No, as minister, you've got to send." We say women have got to go to sea, so we all had to rush quickly. So I formed a small committee, consisting of a chief petty officer, a senior Wren's officer, and a senior Wren rating, and my staff officer, who was a lieutenant commander. And we decided the rules were going to be as short and as simple as possible. And we were the ones, despite what anybody else says, who devised the no-touching rule. And so we did that. And that was really, I suppose, my last claim to fame. Not that I've ever done much.
What work? Can you summarise the rules? It might be difficult now.
To summarise the rules, I think it was there as far as possible, be treated like any other naval personnel in that particular job. You had to take great care in how they were treated and addressed, and for reasons of naval discipline, etc., etc., there was to be this no-touching rule, except in an emergency. So that was that. And then it was taken over by a much bigger in charge of another old friend of mine, Tim England, who had a bigger committee with the Commandant Wren's and goodness knows what, who did the sort of nuts and bolts, but we did the initial work on it. So then I was retired, sent off on resettlement courses.
Now, what were they like?
They were actually a very good value. They were a series of courses designed to fit you for life in civilian. And you could pick what sort of choice. I shall never forget Admiral Sir Henry Leach, noted First Sea Lord, and Mrs. Thatcher's right-hand man at the Falklands, going and doing a bricklayer's course in Portsmouth Barracks. And you could do that sort of thing, plumber's course, anything. And most of us did sort of CV writing courses or computer courses or things like that. which was interesting at the time, but not one of them was any use to me. Getting actually the job I did get in my second career, in the end.
I'll come to that. We just briefly touch on getting you back into civilian life. So you did these courses, and then what's the actual process of leaving?
I mean, Portsmouth. Well, you, like any other good naval personnel, you had to return your respirator and your identity card. And that was about it.
And what was the date you left?
Well, it was last day of pay. Last day of pay was something like the 19th of July, 1991, off the top of my head. You then... Was that last... Yeah, or was that the last day I was in? No, I think that was the last day of pay. And then before that, you have terminal leave. And I had about 3 or 4 weeks leave, I suppose, before that.
So you finished essentially...
Finished the courses in June.
So you worked till 1991 as captain of the fleet?
Oh, yeah.
Now, so what we're going to... What we do now is really get you back to look at what your post-service career... So you've been in the Navy forever, as far as you're concerned.
Oh, yes, 38 years.
Which is a lifetime. Mm. Now, what were you going to do? I mean, you had these courses, but they don't seem to have amounted to that much. CV writing, a bit of computer work... What were you going to do? What plans?
Well, I had some idea. I mean, at the age of 55, you're looking for a second career. You're not looking to sit in your backside just doing nothing with your pension. I was married then, and my wife was expecting me to work, and they wanted to keep out from under her heels. I did not want to go into industry or commerce. It was just not my scene. Or anything technical, IT or anything like that, was just not me. I was, if you like, an organizer, administrator, and I was always very, very keen on old buildings, particularly old cathedrals, and I was a great lover of church music. So I thought I would like to go and be administrator of a cathedral. And to that end, in my resettlement courses, I did the sort of CV writing and a bit of computer stuff towards that end. I mean, there was nothing specialist in those courses that would have fitted me specifically for cathedral. But in those days, ex-service officers and people like that could normally find decent jobs as bursars of schools was a favourite one. But I looked at that and I thought, no, I'm not sure I could stare in the face with these kids all the time. And I was much more interested in cathedral administration. I was just about to apply for... Well, I was asked to go to St. Paul's in London because the Archdeacon of Cheltenham, whom I'd taken to see in HMS Gloucester, was now the Dean of St. Paul's in London. And the head verger from Gloucester Cathedral, who had also been to see with me, was the head verger at St. Paul's. But I missed that because I couldn't get out of the Navy quick enough, and some Army brigadier got it. Thank goodness, because they had a mutiny of vergers shortly after that. I wouldn't have wanted to work in London in retrospect. And then Chester Cathedral came up, and I thought, right, that sounds... sort of thing, and I'd written off asking for the details of that, and a couple of other bursars of schools jobs. When my father-in-law, who was a GP in Coventry, said, "Oh, I hear the master of the Lord Leicester Hospital in Coventry, who's a retired naval captain, is looking to retire again. They want another sailor to replace him." Now, the Lord Leicester Hospital in Warwick is a tourist attraction. It's a group of 15th century buildings, a great hall, a chapel, a beautiful medieval courtyard. Although it's called a hospital, no medical connotation. It just provided hospitality or a home. And since 1564 for old soldiers. Now all three members of all three services, and there are 8 flats for them, all their wives, and a few other cottages attached, which were let to other elderly folk. And it was a tourist attraction, open throughout the year, but the residents, or the brethren as they were called, actually worked to help the hospital run as a viable financial concern, and they acted as guides and ticket sellers, and they lived there rent free, and we paid their council tax. Now I had to, the house went with the master, wonderful, great, lovely medieval house went with the job. So I went there, was interviewed, and interviewed by Lord de Lisle, who was the patron down in Kent, and offered the job.
So you did that from 19...
So I went there from 1991 to 2003.
That's your job to retirement then?
And that was my job to retirement.
Now, the last question we ask is, how did you acclimatise to civilian lifestyle after 38 years in a service life, an all-male environment, a disciplined environment? You know, how did you manage to get yourself sorted when you came out and were a civilian and had no power of, you know, you're not in command of anything?
Yes, it was to some extent. I mean, it was a slope, because although I didn't have the backing of the Naval Discipline Act, I was there in a, if you like, a stone frigate, firmly aground in this ancient pile in Warwick, which was my own command. And the brethren there all had service background. They weren't all regulars, and they weren't all Navy, but they knew what I talked about, and they could understand that we all went to chapel every morning and had to be there on time and properly dressed and, you know, as an image. So part of that work was already done for me. I was still living with, mind you, their average age was 71 instead of 21.
So there was a bit of a come, I mean...
So it was a gradual letdown. What I did find difficult to adapt to was dealing with outside firms, subcontractors, caterers. Oh, my goodness. First of all, the cost of various things like marketing, advertising. I couldn't believe how much it cost to market and advertise. It really, any other service, I could not. I found it very difficult to take. If you engaged a firm to come on a certain day to do a certain job, the odds are they wouldn't turn up, and how much you'd have to chase them up. And it was that, really, you know, agreeing with somebody to do a job and you trusted them and they didn't turn up. And it was continual chase, chase, chase.
And that's not what you were used to in the Navy?
No. I mean, I won't say instant obedience, but you knew you could rely on somebody to do a particular job. And also employing, we occasionally employed casual labourers or even others who came in, is how much you had to keep an eye on them, particularly the more lowly skilled. I can understand this to some extent, because some of the jobs were pretty soul-destroying, I think. But you had to keep an eye on them. So it was a question of much more supervision, if you like, much more, I won't say hands-on management, much, but you had to really
keep your eyes on them. So less taking
on
trust.
Yes, yeah.
Did you get used to it, or do you still find it a frustration?
I got used to everything except the lack of loyalty sometimes. Because, I mean, I'd spent 38 years being totally loyal to my subordinates and my bosses. Sometimes I didn't like them, but if I didn't like either of the subordinates or the bosses, I knew that within 2 years they'd gone. Either I would go or they would go as a normal course of events. So any clash of personalities, you had to stick it out.
Now, what do you think's the value of your naval experiences? I mean, what has it brought you? When you were at Warwick at the Lord Leicester Hospital, but generally, what good or bad has it done you? I presume you're going to say it did you good, but I mean, what did your naval experiences give you?
Well, I've no experience of anything else to judge it by. I think it gave me a sense of loyalty, a sense of responsibility, particularly with regard to looking after other people and watching for their welfare. It gave me, particularly, which I wasn't able possibly to exercise in the hospital, it gave me a tremendous respect and admiration for most of the young people of today and their ability, and a tremendous desire in me to encourage they make the best use of their abilities and get on as best they can. I occasionally used to meet in the Navy youngsters. I said, oh, you're bright enough and you've got the intelligence to become a leading seaman or whatever it was. Oh, don't want the responsibility, sir. And that really used to get me. I used to take that as a personal insult or challenge to me, because I just think that if you've got the ability, you know, get on and do the job.
So you don't regret it for a moment?
Not a minute. I enjoyed every minute of my time in the Navy. I think I probably left at the right rank at the right time.
Thank you very much.